Well, today in our Big Questions of Life series, we come to a big question for most of us about money. And money really does become a big thing in our lives, even as Christians. As a matter of fact, it's surprising how often the Lord himself talked about money. And so it does come up. It is important. It's a big question. And so today we handle that question. What is the value of money for my life? As a Christian, what is the real value of money for my life? Can money buy happiness, for example? Well, in a sense, yes, when it comes to survival. So money can usually relieve the very real physical misery that comes from malnutrition, exposure to the outdoor elements, living among bullies, and living without access to medical expertise. Of course, there are times when you lose a war or you're in economic depression and some people have money, but they still cannot have relief from misery if there's no food on the shelves, right? If we lose a war, that kind of thing. So money doesn't cure everything, but it certainly can lend something to your happiness. Then there are tangible pleasures. Like after relieving the raw misery that we talked about a moment ago, money can usually provide an increase in pleasant physical and emotional life experiences. So, for example, you could go from the most basic nutrition. Yeah, I could live, you know, a long life on this nourishment. And you can go all the way then to foods with great taste and lots of variety and greater nutritional value. And so you can move, if you have money, from the basics to something pretty special. Same thing when it comes to shelter. You could have basic shelter like Abraham Lincoln's log cabin, and that's pretty good. And you can go all the way to granite countertops and stainless steel appliances, and money can do that for you. And there's some pleasure in that. I think maybe it was harder for Abraham Lincoln to live in his log cabin than it is for us to have central heating on a day like this. So that's very pleasant. That's very nice that we have these things. And we can move from basic medical attention, okay, we can give you first aid, to maybe curing your cancer or something that really threatens your life if we have enough money. So money can buy happiness in that sense, but of course we realize that there are limits to that. Emotional pleasures. So beyond the tangible pleasures that can come from food and from shelter and from health care, those kinds of things, money can also provide, if you have money, opportunities for learning and creating and exploring. So, for example, you might travel if you have adequate money, but if you don't have enough money, you won't be a traveler. You might be able to pick up a musical instrument, learn how to play that. That's fun. You might be able to learn a new language. You might be able to restore a car in your garage or restore an antique airplane in your garage. If you're very clever, you can take up woodworking and that sort of thing. And that's nice, but it's going to take a certain amount of money to make that happen. And, of course, there are ego-stimulating things that can be purchased. People might give you applause if you have money, and so that brings some sort of pleasure in the world to a lot of people. But we find out that happiness from money usually plateaus when these things happen. If you have enough food, to begin to be bored with it. It's like, I don't want any more food. I'm full. When you are reliably safe and comfortable in whatever shelter you have. Like, yeah, it doesn't mean that the hot water heater never goes out, but for the most part, it's a pretty great place. When you are more or less pain-free in your health. When you have enough leisure time to begin to be bored with leisure time. And when you have enough social interaction to begin to be bored with that, then it doesn't matter how much money you throw at this. It's not going to make any difference in your happiness if those are the things that you're relying on for happiness. If you base your happiness on the wrong things, for example, having a healthy body, having a romance, having a group of friends that you love, having some sort of creative pursuits. You know, if I can't do this hobby, then my life is just over. So if you base your happiness on those kinds of things and they for some reason go away, then money cannot heal your unhappiness. You're going to have something better than money for that. So here's where we're going today. What is the true value of money for my life as a Christian? And I'm going to point out two wonderful things that money can do. In the first place, God often sends money to inspire his children to become more warm and loving and thankful toward him. And in the second place, God often sends money to provide his children with opportunities to serve him. And what's really interesting, as you see at the bottom of this slide, sometimes those two points are in direct conflict with one another. And so we're going to start by realizing that God often sends money to inspire his children to be more happy and thankful. One of the nicest verses in the New Testament along these lines is from 1 Timothy 6:17. Here the Apostle Paul says, "Command those who are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy." A lot of people imagine that the Bible probably tells you to give away all your money. But the Bible doesn't really say that. The Bible has said that that was true of some people. But as you see here, Paul doesn't tell the wealthy people in his orbit to give away all their money. Instead, he says, don't be proud, but trust in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. The Lord has given us these things richly, so generously, so graciously. He's given us richly all these things, you know what? So that we would enjoy them. Isn't that something? They don't have to give away all their money. They're just supposed to love the Lord for being so wonderful in giving those things. And here's the millennial ideal. When we get to the end times, this is the way the prophets say the world will be in the kingdom here on earth when Jesus reigns. And notice how beautiful this is. This is the Lord's plan for you, for all of us human beings. Micah 4:4. They shall sit every man under his vine and fig tree. Imagine under your grapevine, you have a grape arbor that goes up and over your head, and you sit in the shade of it, which means something if you live in a hot Middle Eastern climate, right? Every man shall sit under his vine and fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. Doesn't that sound good? In the end times, when everything is made right, that's the way it's going to be. Nobody's afraid. You're sitting in the shade with friends. What could be better than that? And look at the Zechariah text. In the end times, thus says the Lord, Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, and the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets. Isn't that something? The prophets, you know, what do prophets care about boys and girls? It's like, no. When the Lord makes everything right, there's going to be boys and girls just playing in the streets. Won't that be nice? Isn't that great? That's the millennial ideal. The Lord is not looking to be this cruel God who wants to take away all your joy. This is what he really wants. And in the end times, this is the way it will be. In the meantime, we come as close to this as we can. We notice in the Gospels that Jesus' wealthy friends, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, had substantial wealth. John Mark's mother had substantial wealth. The church met in her house. Joseph of Arimathea had substantial wealth. And as far as we can tell, they never gave away their wealth. They never redistributed their wealth. They might have done that, but the Bible doesn't say that they did that, certainly not during the lifetime of Jesus. They were, as Proverbs 22, verse 4 says it, they were examples of righteous people who by humility and the fear of the Lord gained riches and honor and life. And that's not bad. The Lord never made them give away all their stuff. But riches always add to our lives a formidable layer of temptation. Riches are kind of scary. So Mark 10:24, children, Jesus says, how hard is it for those who trust in riches to enter into the kingdom of God? It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. So riches are kind of scary. They add a huge layer of temptation to your life if the Lord gives you riches. Same thing in Mark 4:18. This is the parable of the sower and the seed, right? And these are they which are sown among thorns. And these people hear the word and the cares of this world, and see what it says here, and the deceitfulness of riches and the lust, covetousness for other things enter in and choke the word. So sometimes when the Lord entrusts you with riches, they actually choke out the value of his word in your heart. And that's such a shame. An interviewer once said of Boy George, the celebrity, he said, the instant stardom of Boy George led him to a drug and heroin addiction. And Emily Freeman, a Christian author, was talking about this. And she said, if our souls were made for fame, wouldn't we more often hear statements like, his instant stardom led him to a life of peace, joy, and happiness? But we never hear that, do we? Same thing with wealth. You think, wow, the guy was a total addict to alcohol or drugs. And he got a boost in his finances and he was all better. Love, joy, and peace in his life. It's never like that. you hear about the celebrity culture, and they have endless money and endless fame, and then they ruin their lives. Is that interesting? Because riches add a huge layer of temptation. So God often sends money. We want to be careful about this, right? God often sends money to inspire us, his children, to be more warm and loving and thankful to him. And that's wonderful. But notice number two here. God often sends money to provide his children with opportunities to serve him. And that's a really big deal. In Scripture, we believers are constantly urged to be what we now call influencers in the world. You, as a believer, are supposed to be an influencer in the world. And this is everywhere in Scripture. In Matthew 5, we are supposed to be salt and light. Let your light shine before men. In Matthew 28:19, we're supposed to all go out and teach all the nations. We're going to teach them all. And what are we going to teach them? All things that the Lord taught his disciples. We're going to teach them. In Acts 1:8, you're going to be witnesses of me. You have to go influence people for Jesus. In Colossians 3:16, we're going to be teaching and admonishing one another. We're going to influence one another. We're all influencers, right? In Titus 2:4, the older women are going to teach the young women how to do it. They're going to be influencers. In 2 Corinthians 5:20, we're going to be ambassadors for Christ. And everywhere in the New Testament, we have these exhortations to show, to prove, to shine, to influence the world. It's what we do. It's what we are here in this world to do for Jesus. And what's really interesting, and this surprises us, because we just talked about the formidable layer of temptation that comes with riches. But notice what happens if you are poor and you're trying to influence people. In the book of Proverbs, chapter 14, verse 20, the poor is hated even of his own neighbor, but the rich person has many friends. Think, oh, wow, well, when it comes to influence, poverty might not be great. So maybe the Lord is going to lift me out of poverty so that I have more influence. Maybe not, but maybe. Same thing in Proverbs 19:4. Wealth makes many friends, but the poor is separated from his neighbor. Proverbs 19:7. All the brothers of the poor hate him. How much more do his friends go far from him? He pursues them with words, but they are lacking for him. They all run away from him because he's poor. So if the Lord wants you to be an influence, he might entrust you with a certain amount of money so that you will not be poor and have that natural obstacle to overcome when you try to influence others. Charles Spurgeon is so great in his little handbook, John Plowman. The idea is, I'm just an ordinary farmer, and here's what I know. And he has lots of pithy little cliche sayings. But anyway, he says, all the neighbors act like cousins to the rich man, but the poor man's own brother does not know him. And the wealthy man can be heard for half a mile if he only whispers. But widow needy is not heard across the park railings, let her call as she may. Well, of course, that's exactly what the book of Proverbs says. You have money and everybody wants to know what you're about. You're poor, nobody cares what you have to say. So maybe the Lord is going to give you a little bit of money so that you can have influence and avoid the difficulties of overcoming poverty when it comes to influence. But remember, when the Lord gives you money, your money is not an ownership, it's a stewardship. You think, what's a steward? Steward, we always hear that in Christianity. What's a steward? You wouldn't say steward today. You would say an administrative assistant. And in Bible days, this would be an administrative assistant who actually lives on your property. And so you'd be a VIP with an administrative assistant who does what you want that administrative assistant to do. The administrative assistant, the steward, lives on the VIP's property, enjoying grand comforts like, it's not my house, but I get to live here. It's pretty great. It's not my backyard with a fountain and a beautiful pond and all of these pools and luxuries. But I get to live here. I get to use that stuff. It's pretty great, but it's not mine. I just live here. All right, so the administrative assistant steward lives on the VIP's property, enjoying grand comforts and beautiful surroundings, but constantly handling assets that are not their own. And while they handle these assets, they are constantly mindful that the VIP might have certain wishes for those assets, and it's your job to make those wishes come to pass. They're not yours. That's stewardship, not ownership. In this world, even lost people are stewards. They just don't know it. But you're a believer, and you know it. You don't get to keep your house. You're going to die and somebody else is going to have that house. You don't get to keep your car. You don't get to keep your clothes. You keep nothing. You have it for a little while and then it goes away. Those are God's things that you're handling. And you're just an administrative assistant to God's things. In Luke 19:12, you have, you know, the wonderful example of this. A certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called his 10 servants, stewards, administrative assistants. And he delivered them 10 pounds. And he said to them, do business till I come. You see, it's not their stuff. They're going to live on his property and they're going to have his money in their hands, but it's not theirs. You do business till I come. In verse 15, came to pass when he returned, having received the kingdom, then he commanded these servants to be called to him that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. It's not their stuff, but they get to live on the property and there's going to be a reward if they handle the assets of the master well. And that's exactly what we're doing in this world. We are stewards, not owners. Now we've established that God might send you things richly to enjoy. That's so nice. And then you will love the Lord and appreciate him so much. And that's a wonderful thing. God loves that and you love that. So that's why he might give you some really nice things in life. Even kind of a lot of money. American income compared to how many places in the world would make us feel and seem rich. So the Lord has given us kind of a lot of money, right? Even the poorest among us have kind of a lot of money. Maybe the Lord did that so that we would warmly thank him and just appreciate him and draw close to him. And God likes that and we like that. And maybe the Lord is giving us kind of a lot of money because that makes an opportunity for us to serve him. And what's really weird now is those two points are at cross purposes. They collide. So here's what it sounds like in your day-to-day life. Should I use God-sent money for more personal enjoyment? Because he does give us richly all things to enjoy, right? So should I use my God-sent money for more personal enjoyment? Or should I use it for more service to Christ? Which, he put money in my account. Why? And there are a lot of issues here. There are so many wisdom layers here to unpack. So, for example, if I dress in ugly clothes and drive a worn-out and unreliable vehicle, will anyone want to be with me? Remember the Proverbs text about poor people. Will anyone want to be with me? And more importantly, will anyone want to be like me? They see I'm a Christian. Will they want to be a Christian because they look at me? Second question. If I live in a neighborhood of bullies, will my children be physically or emotionally damaged from that environment because evil communications associations do indeed corrupt good manners, right? So will my children be physically or emotionally damaged by that environment, or will they be led astray from Christ? And even, will I be led astray in that environment? Will I get jaded, cynical, embittered? Or like this, if I give away all my enjoyments and I work without rest, will I still be emotionally well and adoring in my attitude towards God? Will I? Lastly, is God depositing this money into my account because he wants me to richly enjoy it or give it away for his pleasure and reputation in the world? Why did God put this money in my account? It's not mine to own, it's mine to steward. And I have to figure out why God put this extra money in my account. And here are three guiding priorities while you're trying to figure this out. And it is genuinely hard to figure out. We are asking the Lord for his guidance and wisdom in these matters. Work ethic. We talked about that last week. If you have a good work ethic, there's a pretty good chance that in a free country like this, the Lord is going to put more money in your account. And now you'll have to decide what to do with it. If you don't have a good work ethic, then you're not going to have as much money either to enjoy or to give away. We talked about that last week. Now we're going to talk about simplicity. And by this, we mean a simple lifestyle. We mean a thrifty lifestyle. Do not cultivate expensive tastes. Don't require expensive things. And we're going to talk about generosity. These are great Christian virtues that guide us as we try to decide what to do with this money that the master has put in our stewardship account. So here's the question. Why would any reasonable person ever allow his schedule to get so busy that his stress levels cause him depression, anxiety, or anger. In other words, we have lost the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, and peace, and traded it for anxiety, depression, and anger. Why would any thinking Christian person do that? And the answer is because we want fame. Well, it's not really going to be fame. What we really want is admiration and attention. We want to be treasured. And so we do things to make people think we're swell. And similarly, fortune. We would like to have a more secure and leisurely life. Fame and fortune. We know we're probably never going to be famous or have a real fortune, but we would like for people to think we're wonderful, and we would like to have security even if things fall apart a little bit. And for that, we will work ourselves so many hours that we lose our love and joy and peace, and instead inherit depression, anxiety, and anger. Anti-simplicity, anti-thrift, cultivating expensive tastes. It all starts so young with us, doesn't it? Here was an article not too long ago by Mimi Doe, who actually consults with students on getting into top-flight colleges and universities. She gives the story of Tanner McArdle. He was not accepted to Stanford, even with his perfect ACT score and a grade point average above 4.1. And also, he's a cross-country athlete and an orchestra member. And the principal of his high school in Minnesota said, "It floored me. He's at the top of his class, and he can't get into Stanford. Are you joking me?" And she says, "It's no joke, Mr. Farley. Kids like Tanner McArdle are a dime a dozen in today's admissions pool. What do you want the kid to do? I mean, if you're going to compete, if you're going to really, really compete for the top spots, then you're not going to have a simple lifestyle. You're going to have a very, very complicated lifestyle that might drive you to depression, anxiety, and anger." We all yearn to feel like people admire us, think that we're wonderful. By the way, no matter how old you are, if your parents are still living, you will want your parents to be proud of you. You will want your parents to think you're wonderful. And you could be very old. I am very old now, so I know this is true. And you will want your parents to think you're wonderful. It's strange. Emily Freeman, again, Christian author. She says, "In my own work, I sense a grief that accompanies small, a disappointment that highlights my own pride and stubbornness, and desire for credit and attention. I want people to think I'm wonderful." Kevin DeYoung, excellent author, Bible scholar, pastor. He says, "The presence of extreme busyness in our lives may point to deeper problems, a pervasive people-pleasing, a restless ambition, a malaise of meaninglessness." Obviously, your life cannot possibly be silly or trivial or meaningless if you are so busy, completely booked, in demand every hour of the day. Oh, you are important, aren't you? And so we drive ourselves and we drive ourselves. And some of us, he says, some of us never rest because we are still trying to prove something to our parents, our ex-girlfriend, or a high school coach. And so, no, we don't cultivate a simple lifestyle. We get busier and busier and busier. And what's really sad is sometimes we're not just doing this so that other people think we're swell. We're sorry to admit that sometimes we're doing it to try to earn God's favor. We're trying to make God think that we're really something. That's so sad, isn't it? Again, Kevin DeYoung, "I think most Christians hear these urgent calls to do more for the Lord, right? These urgent calls to do more, or they feel them, even if they don't hear them, they feel them internally already. And they learn to live with a low level of guilt that comes from not doing enough. We know we can always pray more and give more and evangelize more. So we get used to living in a mild state of disappointment with ourselves." That is so sad. The fruit of the Spirit is love and joy and peace. But I don't feel joy and peace. I feel this low-grade fever of guilt and disappointment with myself. That's just so sad. Don't let that be you. Emily Freeman again says, "Attention, success, and comparison hold my soul hostage and refuse to negotiate until they get what they want. And spoiler alert, they want everything and they are never satisfied. They will never let you go. We need a rescuer to come and save us from the bondage of the lie that whispers we have to build and grow and be known by all. Everybody should think I'm wonderful, and I'm just going to keep working until everybody thinks I'm wonderful. Matthew 16:26 says, "For what is a man profit if he should gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" Of course, some people sell their souls to sin and go to hell for it. You know, they have literally exchanged their sin for their soul forever. But even we as Christians, we're tempted to sell some fraction of our soul. Like, I see over there in Scripture that I'm supposed to be walking with the Spirit and seeking His wisdom so that I have His love and joy and peace. I see that, but instead, I maintain a lifestyle that is so busy that I have, instead of love and joy and peace, I have anxiety, depression, and anger. That's just so sad. You have traded your soul fractionally for money or applause, whatever that is. 1 Timothy 2:1. This is not bigger, more well-known, more impressive. This is something else. "I exhort, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men." We'll pray for kings and for all that are in authority, and here's what we're praying for. "That we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty, because this is good and acceptable to God." Isn't that interesting? The Lord doesn't necessarily need you to build and grow and become known by everybody. It's good and acceptable to Him if you just lead a quiet and peaceable life. And that's never going to make you famous, but it's good in the Lord's eyes. Simplicity means that you don't have to sacrifice everything, because oftentimes that's not even what the Lord wants you to do. Martha's efforts as a hostess, you remember the story in Luke 10, right? She's busy serving. You think, wasn't that great? No, it wasn't great. It was very, very sacrificial, and it was also a total waste of time. Not only was her sacrifice a total waste of time, it was exactly what Jesus did not want her to do. Mary sat at Jesus' feet, and that's what Jesus wanted Martha to do. But Martha had this idea that she had to sacrifice something. Sometimes the Lord is going to ask you to sacrifice something, everything, even your own life. But not all the time. And you have to ask Him, are you sending me nice opportunities for me richly to enjoy, or was I supposed to use this nice opportunity to serve you? Which is it this time? And there's no one size fits all. You're going to have to walk with the Lord, walk in the Spirit, and seek His wisdom in the moment, and follow Him as best as you can. For him that knows to do good and does not do it, for him it is sin. When you know that the Lord wants you to sit still, then sit still. When you know the Lord wants you to sacrifice, then sacrifice. How about poor Jephthah? Super sacrifice. He sacrificed his daughter. Not only was that a waste, that was a calamity. How many times have we sacrificed? You know, there are things, if the Lord doesn't want a certain thing to be accomplished, you could drain your bank account and work yourself into sickness, and it's not going to happen. You have to find out what the Lord wants you to do. Jephthah had this idea of super sacrifice. It was a waste of time. It was actually a sin. It was a calamity. It was terrible. And how many Christians may have wasted their time and sacrificed something with a calamitous result, because it's not really what the Lord wanted anyway. Gideon might have imagined that super sacrifice would be necessary for him to overcome the Midianite enemy, but it wasn't. You just surround them, break a pitcher, let the torch light shine, blow the trumpet, and say the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. No big sacrifice. The Lord had to do the work. So yeah, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, but not a Martha kind of sacrifice, and not a Jephthah kind of sacrifice. We're asking the Lord for wisdom here. Lottie Moon, one of the most famous missionaries to China, back in the Civil War era, And everybody in China was starving. All the missionaries were giving away all of their money. They're working night and day. And the missionaries are collapsing all around her. They're coming down with what they called in those days nervous exhaustion. Today we call it anxiety attacks. They had to get off the field because they were no longer functioning adults. Get them home and get them well, and we'll see about them ever coming back. So Lottie Moon is watching all of this happen, all these anxiety attacks, missionaries collapsing from what they're calling nervous exhaustion. And here's how she kept that from happening to her month after month. She said, "When I think myself threatened with nervous prostration, I quit work at once and take perfect rest." You say, "Well, why don't you just sacrifice yourself? You know, drive, drive, drive." No. "I quit work at once and take perfect rest. Not all people have the resolution to do this. And of course, not all are so situated that they can do it. I argue thus. I refuse to go any longer. I rest. I get well in a month or so and then take up my work." A month? What a lazy bum. We can't take a month off to keep from getting anxiety attacks. She did. She did it routinely. Sacrifice, yes, but only under the direction of the Lord and remembering that it's possible to sacrifice needlessly. God's provisions are perfect for everything He ever calls you to do, and not one thing more. Sacrifice it if He calls you to sacrifice it, but don't just drive yourself into the ground if He hasn't called you to do it. Don't drain your bank accounts just yet if He hasn't called you to do it. Yes, everything you need, He provides. But if you launch out on your own and say, "I also want to do these things besides what He calls me to do," you're going to find that you have no energy. Matthew 11:28, "Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls." Doesn't that sound good? My yoke is easy and my burden is light. If you're driving yourself to depression, anxiety, and anger, this doesn't sound like what Jesus wanted you to do. We all have yearnings for easier lives, right? The average American home in 1950 was 983 square feet. Today, it's 2,349 square feet. That's a 140% increase in the size of our houses, even though our families have decreased from 3.1 people in the house to 2.5 people in the house. We're thankful we're not the half. Costco closets. Our closets are so big now we can use them for spare bedrooms. Extra pantry space to accommodate bulk purchases. In order to save $12 on paper towels, we build $12,000 super closets to store them in. We could talk about storage space rentals. The self-storage industry grew from 1 billion square feet of storage space in 1998 to 2 billion in 2005. And we just have so much stuff now, even with our big houses and big garage, we can't store it on our own property. We have to rent places. Big engine trucks, SUVs, and muscle cars. Try not to cultivate expensive taste, because these things, if you need them, I mean, if you're pulling a horse trailer, you're going to have to have a dually pickup truck. But you see a guy going, a guy weighs 160 pounds and he's going down the road in a dually pickup truck. Why? It's expensive. Don't do that. I mean, if you want to, it's okay, but don't cultivate expensive taste. What about Starbucks? Our $4 four adjective coffee. I break out in a cold sweat every time I have to order coffee for my wife. That is so hard. I'll have a soy, no whip, mocha, frappa, what's it? You know, who knows? If it takes four adjectives, it can't be right. You know, is there not something a little cheaper that you could do? Kevin DeYoung says, "We work to earn, we earn to spend, and we stay busy because we want more stuff, always more stuff." Try not to be like that. A simple life, a thrifty life. Cultivate simple tastes. In the book, Your Money or Your Life, Vicki Robbins says, "Wait, ask yourself, do I really want another Gazingas? No, it will just go in my Gazingas drawer along with 20 others. There's 5 hours of my life in each of those Gazingases, and I don't even use them. We just keep buying and buying and buying, and then we work and work and work, and then we have depression and anxiety and anger. Just stop. Yearnings are a bottomless pit. You've got to realize that the emptiness in your life has to be met by the Lord, not stuff. Hell and destruction are never full, so the eyes of man are never satisfied. Jesus said to them, take heed and beware of covetousness. That's the yearning. Beware of the yearning. For a man's life does not consist in the abundance of things which he possesses. Hebrews 13:5. Let your way of life be without covetousness. That's the yearnings. Stop yearning. Let your way of life be without covetousness. And be content with the things you already have. You know, you could be content with the things you already have. For he said, I'll never leave you or forsake you. I'll fill that hole in your heart. You don't have to fill those yearnings with another gazingus. That'll never work. 2 Timothy 2:4. No man that wars entangles himself with the affairs of this life. We want to cultivate simple tastes, thrifty tastes. That's what we want, simplicity. The Proverbs, our time is past. But just notice these better texts real fast. Simplicity is better than stress, right? Listen to it. Better is little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble with it. Better is a dinner of vegetables where love is than a stalled ox, or we would say a freezer full of steak and hatred. Better is a little with righteousness than great revenues without righteousness. Better is a dry morsel, a little piece of bread and quietness with it than a house full of sacrifices, again, a freezer full of steaks and strife with one another. Better is a handful with quietness than both hands full with travail and vexation of spirit. Simplicity is better than stress. Financial health is so simple. Financial health comes from spending less than you make over a long period of time. That's the secret for financial security. That's also the secret for the ability to give. The only way you're ever going to be able to give wonderful things to the Lord's work is if you spend less than you make and do this as a matter of routine. It's not sinful for us to prefer a bigger house, a little more space to entertain, a bigger yard with a little privacy, a little elbow room, and a bigger vehicle. We feel a little more safe. And to take our bigger vehicle to go buy a four-adjective coffee. It's not a sin. But here's what you're going to find out. These little indulgences may be contributing little or nothing to your quality of life. Yes, so you got the bigger TV. Are you happier now because you did that? Because that was kind of a lot of money. And you got the dually pickup truck. Has it really contributed anything to your day-to-day happiness? Because it costs kind of a lot of money. So these little indulgences aren't contributing anything to our quality of life. In fact, they may be hurting the quality of our lives. And these are the things, these little indulgences are the very things that are competing with us and holding us back from influencing other people for Jesus. That is not a good trade-off. This testimony comes from David Platt's friend, and I thought we would like to close with a story like this. He says, I cannot believe what the Word and this growing faith have done to my life over the past year. I find myself seeking opportunities to share the Word and discuss my growing faith with others. I stopped saving for the big screen TV. I reduced my 401k contributions, trying to find a way to give some of our savings away in addition to regular contributions to the church. Strangely enough, this gives me greater joy than I have experienced with a quarterly 401k statement showing a profit. What is wrong with me? It's lunacy. The worldly man I was a year ago would not recognize the man I am becoming. I was a man believing in the realities of this world, living the American dream, saving up riches for a comfortable future. Now I believe in, pay to, and seek after a relationship with a God I cannot see. I now look for security in my faith. All this would have sounded like foolishness to the man I was a year ago. So in answer to our question, what is the true value of money for my life? When the Lord gives you a little boost in your income, hopefully that inspires you to just think the Lord is so wonderful and you're grateful to Him. You appreciate Him so much and He loves that relationship and you love that relationship. And then that little boost to your income has done what God wanted it to do. Or maybe that boost to your income has funded your lifelong dream of being able to do things to increase the pleasure and reputation of God in the world. Isn't that great? That was your lifelong dream. And it so happens that that is exactly the basis of your rewards judgment when you stand before the Lord someday. You have invested something of yourself to bring Jesus to the neighborhood where you live and maybe to the mission fields around the world. Isn't that really something? So what is the value of money? It draws me close to the Lord, and I just think the Lord is so wonderful, and we talk about it, and it's great. And it also funds my lifelong dream. That's such a wonderful value for money. But if the money God sends me is not making me warm and thankful toward Him, and it also is not making me a real influence for Jesus in the world, then my money, in fact, my entire time in this world, isn't of any particular value at all. And that's the value of money. It's up to you.